fun concept of absorbing undeserved suffering and complying with the will of God in respect here to a situation of captivity and even martyrdom. As we have pointed out here, the verses should read, "If anyone has an ear, let him hear," verse 9. And 10, "If anyone is destined to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he must be killed." Here is the perseverance and faith of the saints. So point 21 is really where we left off here. The force of this is that God is already aware of his children and knows what the future holds for everyone. Some will face prison and death while others will be delivered. 22, the second couplet has a similar textual problem with some reading, "If anyone kills with a sword, it is necessary for him to be killed with a sword." 23, the issue in this portion of the text is whether the verb is a future active indicative, will kill, as per the King James Version and the New American Standard, or if it is an aorist passive, be killed, as the translations, the NIV, the New International Version, the New Jerusalem Bible, the New English Version, and Young's Literal Translation. 24, there can be little doubt that some of the scribes very much were influenced by the reading of Matthew 26:52, and saw the thrust here as being one of retribution. I mean, that was a well-known principle. In fact, of all the lines that Jesus uttered, that one's still one of the proverbial sayings, "He who lives by the sword will die by the sword," more or less. And so it was recognized and that this was a true principle, and it very much appears that that's what they thought was being taught here. And so they adjusted the text for that. 25, however, this reverses the meaning of the first statement, and it is better to understand both statements in light of Jeremiah 15:2, which we read there, deals with that passage of who goes to captivity goes to captivity. Those destined for death go to death. And so it just depends on what God's will for the believer is, and then each believer has, obviously, to orient to that. 26, while that passage referred to unbelieving Israel, here it applies to believers. And that's another whole principle, is in the context there of Jeremiah. It's dealing with Israel under unbelief and judgment. And here we're dealing with the concept of believers orienting to God's plan for their life. They're under judgment, but not from God and not through any fault of their own. They live in the wrong time in history, we might say. 27, God will not intervene to prevent persecution, for it is part of his purposes and results in the fulfilling of his will. Thus, his people will accept their destiny, knowing that not a hair of their heads can perish, as per Luke 21:17-18. And so, as again, you, one of the things you should recognize, if you study doctrine very carefully and very seriously and for very long, you're going to recognize that there are conflicting principles in the Bible. The Bible doesn't contradict itself, but there are principles that say, don't worry. Don't spend too much time looking ahead. Don't worry about tomorrow. Don't plan ahead. Don't concern yourself with that. God has all that under control. And then you've got all kinds of other principles, like Proverbs. It says, know well the condition of your flocks and plan ahead. And it's a fool that doesn't do his work in the summer. And, you know, it says, go to the ant, you sluggard, and learn something from him, how he plans ahead and all of this. Well, the question becomes, at what points do you know when to plan ahead, and at what points do you know when to relax and trust God? And that, obviously, is very liberating, to have those things in order. To know that, number one, you can relax and trust God, that, look, as he said in other passages, your Father feeds the birds of the air. They have plenty of food, and they're taken care of, and don't you think you're more valuable than birds? And the answer is, yes, we do think we're more valuable than birds. And so God's going to take care of us. And also in terms of this, the persecution thing, Luke 21:17-18, you will be hated by all on account of my name, yet not a hair of your head will perish. But by your endurance, you will save your lives, your patience, you're hanging in there. And the deal here is, of course, and this is in the context of persecution and suffering, and people delivering them up, turning on them, that could very well, we would expect, be a part of Daniel's 70th week as well. But yet God's not going to let a hair of your head perish. I mean, he knows how many hairs are on your head right now. He knows how many of them are gray. He knows which ones you've colored. He's completely aware of all this stuff about us. I mean, minutia that we probably would think, well, why would he care? But he does. And he uses these types of teaching aids to demonstrate the depth of his concern. That God isn't just, oh, I'm God and I'm in heaven and I don't really care about what's going on in your life. He's definitely interested. Well, 28, the sword in this context is a reference to capital punishment visited on believers that will not comply with the government of the beast, Revelation 13:4, where we see a similar use of the word sword. When he's talking about the government, rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior. If you never ever speed, when you see the cop behind you with the lights on, you're not afraid. At least you shouldn't be. If you never break the law, the government's nothing to fear. The only people that fear the government are those who violate the laws. And rightly so. And this is legitimate fear. You better fear the government. You say, well, I don't have to be afraid of the government. Oh, I think you better. The Bible's pretty plain on this. But for evil, and here in the context of good behavior, we might say law-abiding behavior. And evil in this context means criminal behavior. The criminals fear the government. The criminals fear the police. You see them all the time on these shows, cops. Cop will walk up, start to talk to him, the guy bolts. All he wanted to do was see if he had a light for a cigarette. And the guy goes off running. Well, guess what? He betrayed the fact that he's a criminal. He's definitely guilty. I don't find myself, you know, if a cop approaches me, I don't find myself thinking, run. So that's because I'm not involved in this criminal activity that they are. Or whatever else he's doing there. So the government, to do what is good, and we might say do what is law-abiding, do what is right, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. In other words, this is a threat that up to and including capital punishment, the government has the right to take out undesirables out of society. And, of course, in Paul's day, it wasn't like we have the modern prison system where you take these undesirables and put them together with a bunch of other undesirables and feed them and clothe them and house them and all that. If you went to prison, it was to die. You didn't go to prison for any other reason. You weren't left in prison for an extended period of time, generally speaking. You had the right to a pretty speedy trial, which is a fundamental right of most normal civilized societies. And when you had your trial, you had the right to present witnesses and all that, just like you would in any other normal court of law. But then if the judge passed sentence and you went back to prison, you were going back to prison to wait for death. That was all you would be there for. You were either in prison waiting for trial or you were in prison waiting to die. And so Paul recognized that the government has the right of capital punishment, which is a principle, obviously, another one of the politically correct things we're not allowed to challenge, that capital punishment is somehow wrong, that it's cruel and unusual. It's not cruel, and it's not unusual. I mean, I can give you a number of painless ways to kill these people. If you don't want to use the electric chair, okay. We can inject them with a deadly cocktail, and they'll just fall asleep and die. They won't go through any real pain. We can put a bullet in their head, they'll die instantaneously. You know, it won't be as though they suffer. I mean, I guess the worst part of it's here in the ready aim. And about time fire hits your ear, you're dead. But that's quick. You know, beheading them is quick. That's permanent. It's, you know, fast. I suppose the only real horrible part of that is here in the whoosh as the guillotine comes down. That's the last thing you hear, whoosh. And then you're gone. And so they say, that's cruel. It's not cruel. If they've killed somebody else, they've forfeited their right to live. But in our society, of course, you're not allowed to articulate these principles. But the Bible's real plain on them, that the government has the right of capital punishment, and in Paul's day, used it regularly. That's the way it should be today, but obviously we've the land of confusion, we've turned everything around. So again, it does not bear the sword for nothing. It is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices criminal activity. Evil in this context, criminal activity. And in that case, who practices murder, we might say, because that's one of the capital offenses. There were a number of capital offenses. but that certainly was one of them. Well, 29, as we have pointed out repeatedly, there is a time and place for civil disobedience on the part of believers, but there is also the potential for dangerous and deadly repercussions for such disobedience. And so we would counsel believers, you better have your doctrinal ducks in a row. Daniel chapter 3, of course, I'm not going to read that whole chapter, but you better have your doctrinal ducks in a row if you're going to disobey the government. And you better know what you're doing, you better be right, and you better be prepared to suffer the consequences. As I've said before, you don't have to pay taxes. But be aware that if you don't, the government will come looking for you. And when they find you, they aren't going to be nice about it. They're going to confiscate everything you've got, probably, put you in jail, and all of that. So do you feel that strongly about taxes that you want to risk all that? No, I don't. And while I, you know, don't particularly care for excess taxation, at a certain level, you just have to, like these people, you're just going to have to endure it and move on. Recognize we live in the most evil time in history, in which these global Luciferian humanists are manipulating economies and societies and the world order in order to accomplish their ends, lining their pockets. I don't hear any of the gas companies complaining about profits now, do you? And the idea here is that, you're getting rich. You're doing real well financially. Unfortunately, you picked a bad time in history to start saving your money, because this isn't the time in history you're going to suddenly lose it all. And so these capitalists who basically run our government, that's no secret. Your vote counts. I can get you a political action committee that's vote counts a lot more than yours does and who has a lot more influence on the politicians than yours does. You can do whatever you want, but the reality is, if you got money behind you, you can buy whatever vote you want from whatever congressman you want. We all know this. If you don't know this, you're pretty naive, and it's time for you to grow up, and so that's why you're here. So you can hear this, that it doesn't, you know, money runs the government. It's not the other way around. The government, and again, the Fed, that's a totally evil organization. It's not even a part of our government. It's a series of bankers who have taken over and hijacked the U.S. money supply, took us off the gold standard, did all kinds of incredible evil, and continue to manipulate interest rates and all of that to suit their own agenda. Oh, you think they don't have an agenda? Oh, they have an agenda. What's their agenda? Well, if I listen to Alan Greenspan, his agenda is to protect me from inflation. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. No, that's not their agenda. But that's what he says as he stands there peering off into the distance to see economic indicators that warn him of the approach of the deadly inflation beast. And only he can see this stuff, and only he knows what needs to be done. And we're supposed to buy this? Sell, pass. Not interested. So the government has the right to do, and they got the power, and you better acknowledge that. And if you feel strongly about something and you want to disobey, that's your priesthood. But, you know, ask yourself, if I want to be a good believer in jail. Do you feel that strongly about the principle that, you want to be a good believer in prison? I mean, you can fulfill the will of God there too, right? It's just not near as much fun. So the point is, you can disobey, but my counsel would be, number one, biblically, don't. But if you do, all of Daniel 3 here is about the, as we know, the Nebuchadnezzar, the golden statue he created out there and set it up and commanded worship. And he heard that these three Jews weren't obeying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in verse 13, or their Jewish names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And they were brought before the king, and the king is, and this is another thing about government. Don't assume that government is impassionate, that they always view things from strictly logical and legal status and all that. Here you got a very, very, very mad ruler. And sometimes you may go into a court and you got a mad judge. There isn't anything you can do about it. And here you have Nebuchadnezzar is not, of course, running his government today based on wisdom and insight and all of that. He's running his government this day based on his fury, based on the fact that he's mad. And so Nebuchadnezzar responded, as it says, well, actually in verse 13, in rage and anger. He gave orders to bring them in. And he responded and said to them, for what intent is it that you do not serve my gods or worship the image I set up? Now, I'm going to give you another chance, boys, and you better pay attention. Because if you don't bow down to this thing and you don't comply, I'm going to throw you into a furnace of blazing fire, and there ain't no way in hell your God's going to help you. And if some, you know, government official standing there telling you this, you would be pretty intimidated, I would think. And particularly when we talk government official here, we're talking the king whose word is law. If Nebuchadnezzar said something, it became law. That was it. There was no, you know, it didn't have to be ratified by Congress. He could just speak, and that was it. He got it. So they tell him, okay, look, we don't even need to think about this. This is a no-brainer. Our God can deliver us, and even if he doesn't deliver us, to hell with you and your statue anyway. That's impressive. That's impressive that they had that much confidence in God, and that even if God didn't deliver them, they were willing to die. They weren't going to worship. It was just that simple. And Nebuchadnezzar was filled himself with wrath. I mean, he worked himself up into a dither this day. And he was furious. His facial expression was altered. And, of course, they're talking about the whole, you know, go from a face that, well, when they came in, I'm sure he was upset with them. And you can see when a person's upset. And then when they fly into a fury, you can see the difference on their face. And they got to see it that day. And, of course, he tosses them in, and God delivers them anyway. So, but they didn't care. And that has to be your attitude. If you are going to disobey, you better, one, not care about the consequences. You better have played this through in your head and have recognized, if this is God's will for me, then so be it. But this is where we counsel you. Pray about it. Why would you do something really, really radical just off the top of your head? If God's going to put you in this situation, you'll find yourself there through no fault of your own. Don't go running out looking for fights. And sometimes believers on doctrine do that. They go around looking for fights. I got doctrine. I'm looking for a fight. I'm itching to fight. Well, no. We're not to have that attitude. We're to have a different attitude that is, basically, I'm here to live at peace with all men as much as it's possible. I may not agree with the government or like what they're doing, but I'm going to, number one, support them. They've got the right to do it, and I recognize that God is using all this to fulfill his greater will. I have to look beyond just the obvious, the evil that I can see around me in the conspiracies. The one major big one, of course. The UN's a huge part of all of this. That's a totally evil organization. And the reality is, of course, but you can see all this and say, well, you know what? I know God's got it under control. I can faith rest the fact that this is all coming down the way God knew it would. And that's very, you know, that's very reassuring. You don't have to fight every big battle. God's got a lot of this under control. And these evil people can do all they want. The pharmaceutical companies can have their billions of dollars in profit. Just off of Lipitor last year, I think they made $4.3 billion. You know why? Cholesterol's dangerous. Cholesterol will kill you. Really. But we have a drug that will keep you alive. Now, we can't guarantee it'll keep you alive. But it's expensive, and we make a lot of money off of it, and we'd like to sell it to you. And so the pharmaceutical companies have circumvented the whole medical profession. They've gone directly to the consumer, which should be illegal. You can't prescribe your own drugs. If I can, then I'm going to write some pretty good scripts. I'm going to write scripts for Quaaludes and, you know. I'm going to write scripts for fun drugs, not Lipitor. And so, and there's no guarantee, and of course there's every evidence that some of these drugs just destroy your body in another way anyway. They have horrible side effects, and they're aware of this. So, but the reality is, they're making all their money now. This is a bad time to be doing it, folks. The oil companies are making all their money now. They're cashing in. OPEC is getting wealthier and wealthier by the day. All these people have tons and tons of money. In fact, more money than they know what to do with. And we have to recognize the James 5 deal. Okay, you're laying up your gold and silver in the last days, and it's going to testify against you. And your gold's going to rust, and nuclear rust. It's going to affect it all. So here again, there's a place for civil disobedience if you choose to, but number one, you better make sure you've got a doctrinal principle that you're willing to die for. And that number two, it's God's will for you to make this stand. Don't just assume, well, God wants me to do it. Maybe he doesn't. You have to pray about this. Don't act in a rash fashion in anything. But we would counsel that to any believer anytime in their normal daily life. Don't make quick, rash decisions about things. Stop and think things through, pray about it, consider the issues. You don't have to be in a big hurry. One of the things, you know, that when people come up to you and they're in a big hurry to do something, why are you in such a big hurry? Is this life or death? And in most cases, of course, it's not. What's your big hurry? I got to do this. I got to do it. I got to do it now. Why? Why? What's so important about all this? So don't be in a big hurry. Take your time. Relax. God's plan isn't going anywhere. You know. So 30 here, the force of these couplets is to instruct the believer with respect to the matter of God's will during this time in history, and to encourage them to submit to that will without violent resistance. 31, the final phrase is introduced by the adverb hoda here, which has been twice used previously in this book as an adverb of place. Revelation 4:1 is the first time we saw it. And as I pointed out to you, in terms of place, it means here as opposed to there or somewhere else. After these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven, and the first voice which I had heard, like the sound of a trumpet, said, come up here, and I will show you. Here, obviously, here meaning come up to heaven. And then also it was used in 11:12, also of place. And they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went into heaven. Obviously, heaven is opposed to earth. 32, however, it is also used regularly as an adverb denoting manner and can be translated as thus or in this manner, etc. 33, the usage here is designed to emphasize the reality that the manner in which the saints respond to these attacks, imprisonment, and even death demonstrates their perseverance and their faith. 34, the Greek term hupomone, perseverance, is a compound from meno, to abide or remain. That means to stay, we might say, to stay in one spot as opposed to another. And the preposition hupo, which is under or down, it emphasizes the patience we exercise with respect to the circumstances of life. And again, there's a different word, makrothumia, which is also a compound, but it means patience in respect to people. It actually was translated slow to wrath or long, a long time before getting angry. And we're to have both kinds of patience. We have to be patient with respect to people and work on being slow to anger. I mean, you know, I feel like, you know, that comedian, you know, here's your sign. You see so much idiocy and stupidity out there. And if you got those jokes I sent out, the idiotic jokes about the idiots. Two guys holding up a place, says, nobody move, and his partner moves and he shoots him. That's dumb. And people are so idiotic in certain cases, it's easy not to be patient with them. It's easy to be angry at them. And it's easy to take it out on them. Well, we have to have the makrothumia, too, the slow to anger thing. The don't let people get to you. And that's a challenge because you see so, I mean, this world is so loaded with evil and stupidity and all of that. And people don't really care. And sometimes, you know, one of the things, too, I think as we get older, it's easier to become impatient because we forget how stupid we were. I mean, I'm very impatient with these idiots that pull up beside me with their music blaring so loud, you know, that my underwear is shaking because I can't, the bass line is so heavy that my car is actually moving. You know, and I just want to, you know, pull out a gun and shoot them. Not literally, but blow up their speakers or something. Shoot the stereo out. But you know what? What were you doing when you were 15 and 16 and 17? Did you ever drive around with your music loud? I did. There's God's discipline on me now. Now I got to put up with it. But people forget one of the things, and that's one of the real dangers of getting old. You got to watch yourself. Man, because it's really easy to look down on people. Look at these young people. Look at this new generation. Them and their rap music. Just what my parents were saying about, you know, the Beatles. This rock and roll, this Elvis. He seems pretty benign by modern standards, doesn't he? I mean, you look at groups like Marilyn Manson and, you know, some of these other groups, and Elvis seems pretty benign, really. So as you get older, try to remember that you were young once, too. And that helps. That goes a long way towards being patient with people, because you forget you were young once. And that's one of the things I've seen in believers. Believers grow up spiritually, and that's good. We want believers to grow up spiritually. And they attain a certain measure of maturity and doctrine and all of that. And they're so impatient with younger believers who are still stupid. Not that they ever were stupid in their lives, but... And so you have to be patient, and that's one of the challenges, is patient with people. Because they're going to challenge you, trust me. It'll be all you can do to be patient. But this word focuses on more here, patience with respect to circumstances. Things in our niche we should not try to change. And as a believer, you've got to figure that out. See, it's your priesthood, it's not mine. You've got to figure out where God wants you to be, what he wants you to do, what he wants you to think, say, all these other things. You've got to figure out God's will for your own life. I can't do it for you. And you probably wouldn't want me doing it for you. You'd probably just as soon have your own choices, I would imagine. So once you figure out what God's will is, the key is hanging in there with it. Because everything's not all peaches and cream and fun and games on the way to the bema seat. We know that. It's definitely not. So again here, the way they do this emphasizes their perseverance and their faith. And then this emphasizes the patience with respect to circumstances. 35, this answers to the first circumstance of verse 10 and denotes the patient endurance of those who go into captivity that will be called on to demonstrate. And you're going to have to be patient if you're sitting there in prison. Recognize this is the will of God. It's God's will for me to be here in prison. And I don't really know what the prison structure will be like in those days, but I have to believe it's going to be more like what a prison should be. It's not going to be the country clubs that we have here that Martha Stewart will probably go to. I mean, you know, it'll be like a real prison, a place you don't want to be. And it's not just the bars and the cages and all that. It's, you know, I'm sure the food will be horrible if you get food. A prison could be a pretty nasty place if run right. Well, that's kind of what I want in a prison. I want a prison that's a nasty place. I don't want it to be a place where they go and have fun. That's not my idea of prison. And I have a sneaking suspicion the Antichrist, under their brutal system, that prisons are going to be pretty nasty places. So again, to get past the modern mindset of the average Babylonian, what's a prison like? Well, you've probably never seen a real prison. You go into a third... Now, have you ever seen that movie Midnight Express about the guy that gets busted in Turkey for the hash? That gives you a little bit more of an idea of what a real prison's like. The insane people are in there, you know, and all the abuse that goes on in the prison system, the guards and all that. Well, this is probably going to be more like that. So obviously, as a believer under that, that's going to be a real challenge. And not to lose faith in God. Well, okay... Why did God put me in here? Well, he's got this verse. Okay, I knew that God was going to put some people. I'm the one. Okay, I got to orient to that. 10, the second term, pistis, faith, can be used in two ways. First, to denote faith in the active sense of placing one's trust in something or someone. And passively, to denote the content of faith, what one believes. 37, some have attempted to make it equivalent in this context to pistis. Pistis is the actual word, and there's a difference between pistis. Actually, in the Greek, it's pronounced pistis, but you look at it in English transliteration, and you would probably tend to pronounce the I's as short. And then pistis, faithful. based on a similar context of facing death, and that was in Revelation 2 there. We observed the challenge to the church at Smyrna, who were going to be facing death. Fear nothing of what you are about to suffer, or not one thing. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. And there it uses pistos, be faithful. In other words, remain loyal to me and recognize that this is part of my plan and I know what's going on. However, clearly, point 38, this attitude of submission to the will of God under the most difficult of circumstances clearly demonstrates the faith that these believers have in the doctrine that was just stated. And so their faith with respect to this principle is going to be tested, and they will orient to it. Obviously, we got to believe that some of them will, that they'll recognize, okay, this is God's plan. I may not be what I would have picked, but at this time in history, this is the way it's got to go. And God knows what he's doing. And the way it's got to go is for God to let evil run its course. And by the time God eliminates evil from the universe, everybody is going to be glad. I mean, that's one of the things that the believer longs for, is for this to all be over with. We have, as Paul says, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, the sanctified desire to get out of here, to get out of the devil's world, to have our resurrection bodies and all the blessings that go with that, up to and including SG3. And to recognize that this world is a pretty horrible place, and it's evil, and it's getting worse. And so you have to have the doctrine to recognize that and all that. So again, the fact that they do this demonstrates their faith in this doctrine, and they fulfill it. 39, again, we must limit the saints to Jews and Gentiles in the age of Israel. Since the church age has ended and the church was clearly excluded from the exhortation of verse 9. So he's not talking, as we might say in this passage, to us. But we can obviously take the principle and recognize it's a true one, that as God's plan winds down, it's going to get pretty nasty. That evil is going to run its course, and that when it's all over and done with, we're going to be glad that there's no more evil. We're going to recognize this is great to live in an environment that's not, doesn't have all this. Verse 11 now, and I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. And as I saw here, Kai, with the verb eidon, which is John's way, once again, this is the marker that he's introducing a new subject. When he uses this pretty regularly throughout Revelation, and I saw another, alas. Generally speaking, this word means another of the same kind. There's another word, heteros, which means another of a different kind. But I saw another beast, Therion. And this, of course, is in the context of the first beast he saw in chapter 13, verse 1. I saw a beast. Now, he jumps to his next section, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. Ascending or coming up is the present active participle of anabino. And the interesting thing here is in both of these, in verse 13, I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. Number one, John is pictured here as seeing these things arise in history, which indicates that he sees them come on the stage of human history. The best situation I have would suggest that they are here right at the beginning of Daniel's 70th week. Just following the rapture, both these beasts are going to appear. Now, will they be manifested, we might say, in the character of the beast, of what they actually really are? Oh, probably not. Probably not at all. Now the question becomes, could these beasts be on the earth prior to the rapture? Could be, but I don't see any evidence that they are. I think the church would probably be able to recognize and identify some of this. I don't see that now. But again, at the rapture, a whole bunch of things are going to change. You're back in the age of Israel, and suddenly it's all begins slow, But the miraculous character of this thing just builds and builds and builds until, I mean, every day something miraculous is happening. And I think they'll appear, probably quietly, in history, and show up and begin to do their thing. Now, it's going to take them a while, again, to really get going and to get their following. That takes some time. I mean, you got to get people on the bandwagon. It isn't as though they show up and then suddenly everybody's just rah-rah behind them. This takes some work. But John actually sees them arise here, coming up out of the earth, out of Bino, from preposition ek plus the word get. This is the first difference, obviously, that we see here, is that the first beast came up out of the sea. And the second beast comes up out of the earth. What is the significance of that difference? Well, we'll deal with that. Coming up from the earth, and he had, imperfect active indicative, two horns. Imperfect of echo, the simple verb to have, and then the adjective here, duo. And he had two horns, keras. Same word that we saw before, keras. He had two horns resembling or like. The difference between this and host is host sets up a simile, where homoios tends to emphasize physical resemblance to something. We might say he was strong as an ox. We don't mean that he physically resembled an ox, but we're making a simile. We're setting up a comparison. And the difference between that and homoios is, you know, he looked like a bear. You know, it was just, you know, the physical resemblance, that the guy was huge, probably hairy, and all that kind of stuff. So that's the difference here, is that you have a physical resemblance. He had two horns resembling a little lamb, Arnion. Same word that's been used of the Lord. And he was communicating like a dragon. And as Kai, he was communicating as laleo, to speak, but it has the emphasis of content, whereas the simple verb to say, lego, just emphasizes saying some words. Laleo here emphasizes content. And he had content like a dragon. In other words, his words and the dragon's are very similar. Drakon is the word there with the comparative hopes. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, or on his behalf. And here's a question here. The suggestion has been made, and we'll deal with this phrase, and as Kai first, he does or makes, and they translated this exercise, the simple verb to do, poieo, and he does or has or uses the authority, exousia. And we know that the authority here is very broad because he was given authority over all the tribes and nations and all of that, and he had all that given to him. In verse 7, the Antichrist did. And here you got the false prophet, as he's going to be called, exercising or functioning with that same authority. And we know that that authority came from the dragon. So again, we point out there's a satanic chain of command here too, from Satan to the Antichrist down to the false prophet. And so he had the authority of the beast, Therion, again, with the adjective here, protos, the first beast. And in context, of course, that refers you right back to verse 1. And he exercises all the authority. You actually have the all that comes later in the context here, pos, all the authority, and then enopion is generally means E-N-O-P-I-O-N. It generally means the front of or right before, and it has to do with a spatial orientation. The NET translation suggests on his behalf, which is true enough. But the question becomes here, does the false prophet only do the miraculous things he does when the beast is physically present? And I suspect that's what this is getting at, is that he has his authority, but for some reason he's got to be there. And this is very, very similar, if you remember, in the Exodus out of Egypt, when Moses didn't want to go to Pharaoh because he said, number one, you know, he's given God all these excuses, I can't speak, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so he ends up sending him Aaron with him. And Aaron does all these things, but only does them and says, you know, he acts only in the presence of Moses when he's out there in the public. And it's a very similar situation to that. So I don't have any problem with either translation. I do think there has to be some physical relationship between them two. The false prophet isn't just out wandering around the world acting this stuff out on his own. He's doing it very publicly and visibly only in the presence of the Antichrist. What's he do the rest of the time? Well, we're not told. So on his behalf or in the presence of, either one I think will work here. I'll probably stick within the presence of the first beast on his behalf or in his presence. And he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose fatal wound was healed. And he makes, again, does, preposition poieo, to make or do, the earth. Here, obviously, in terms, we would have to say, clearly, the inhabitants of the earth are what's in view now. Even though he says the earth, we're talking about the inhabitants of the earth. And he makes the earth and those dwelling in it, Harry, very explicit of what he means by the earth. You can even translate this, even those dwelling in it. You got a chi here, which can be used in an ascensive sense. The ones dwelling is katoi keo, again, the definite article with this k-a-t-o-i-k-e-o. Again, those dwelling in it is technical for negative unbelievers. And he makes those dwelling in it in order that, and you have here a kind of a sub-final clause, he makes them dwell on the those who dwell in the earth. They've translated here almost like it's an infinitive. And matter of fact, they've translated it like it's an infinitive, to worship. It's in order that they will worship. He does what is necessary in order to coerce worship, in other words. And that's really the force of it. To worship the first beast. Again, in order that they may worship is proskuneo, the verb to worship, which means literally to bow down towards. The beast, the first. You got Therion with the adjective protos. Who, of whom literally, genitive of the relative pronoun hosts, of whom was healed. Therapeuo again. So it looks like here, again, you have to emphasize the supernatural resuscitation of the beast first, and then the supernatural recovery from a deadly wound. You got plague here, again, the blow or strike, P-L-E-G-E, plague, of death, of his death. And they translated it, whose fatal wound was healed. They've translated here, once again, thanatos, deadly or fatal. The fatal blow, fatal wound, his fatal wound. You got the genitive of autos. All right, well, it's about 10 till. I'm not going to dive into this today, so we will continue here on, have the exegesis out of the way, and continue with the exposition of this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.